Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, February 25th, 2016. I've got a tough love message for my friends who support Hillary Clinton.
You'll never know how much I really love you.
I do love you, Hillary supporters.
You'll never know how much I really care.
And I do really care.
Listen, do you want to know a secret? Promise not to tell. Whoa, 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 closer.
Yes, the dirty secret that many Hillary Clinton supporters don't appear to be able to hear, to recognize, to contemplate, or to process, is that of the two Democrats running for president this year, she is the weaker opponent of Donald Trump. And there are two important articles that have been published in the last 24 hours, and I want to share them with you. And I recognize that already, because of my points of view, that many people who support Hillary Clinton have stopped listening to me. And it's hard to accept that, because I had a conversation with our listener, Gary Kane, that I put on the end of the podcast the other day. He's a Bernie supporter, but he thinks that I am a petulant progressive and that I have trashed Hillary Clinton. And I challenged him on that, and he couldn't come up with any real comments that I've made that amount to trashing of the former Secretary of State. But I am sharply critical of her policies, and I know that that causes some people who support her just to reflexively tune out. And over the weekend, my friend Lisa, who lives in Nevada, was going to caucus for Hillary Clinton. And she put up a Facebook post, and, you know, I support anybody who exercises their democratic voice. But she immediately moved to commenting just flatly that Bernie Sanders is unelectable, and therefore she can't even consider supporting him. Unfortunately, the facts don't support that notion, and that is a notion that is dearly held by so many supporters of the candidate who they hope will become the first woman president. And a lot of it is identity politics, even though many females who support Hillary deny that. And so I'm linking in the show file for this podcast to two important articles. The first is by the editor of Current Affairs. His name is Nathan J. Robinson. And the headline reads, "Unless the Democrats run Sanders, a Trump nomination means a Trump presidency." And I think he's pretty even-handed here in evaluating the strengths and weaknesses of Clinton and Sanders. And he sounds the alarm that Trump does pose a serious threat to the well-being of the country and the lives of many of us who don't identify with his fast-talking, shoot-from-the-lip, billionaire, ego-filled point of view. And Nathan Robinson argues that Clinton supporters will have to do something that is counterintuitive, make absolutely sure that Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee for president. He says the electability question should be at the center of the Democratic primary, and that he's heard over and over people say, "I like Bernie, I just don't think he can win." But if we accept the looming reality that Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee, then we have to be cold, calculating reptilian in deciding who to advance as the Democratic candidate. And this commentary says, a Clinton matchup is highly likely to be an unmitigated electoral disaster, whereas the Sanders candidacy stands a far better chance. Every one of Clinton's considerable weaknesses plays to every one of Trump's strengths, whereas every one of Trump's few weaknesses plays to every one of Sanders' strengths. From a purely pragmatic standpoint, running Clinton against Trump is a disastrous, suicidal proposition. I know this is strong language, and for people who supported Hillary in 2008 and have been waiting for 8 years for what they consider to be her turn, I know this is very hard to accept. But the polls are clear. Hillary has huge unfavorable ratings, and they're not going to change because everybody knows who she is. Bernie Sanders' unfavorables are less than half of Hillary's, and many people still don't really know him as a candidate. And when we think about running Hillary against Trump in a year where the atmosphere is very clear. People are tired of career politicians and longtime establishment figures. Now, Bernie Sanders is a career politician, all right? He's been running for office for 35 years. But as the independent representative and then senator from Vermont, he has carved out a position that is clearly not part of the Democratic establishment. And Nathan Robinson runs down the vulnerabilities of Hillary Clinton, and I won't, impose on your time to simply repeat them. And then he criticizes Clinton as a weak campaigner. He says she is a dreadful campaigner. Now, I don't think it's actually that bad. And she certainly comports herself very well during debates. But his opinion is that she is terrible. He quotes the Washington Post's Jennifer Rubin, who said that Hillary is a rotten candidate whose attacks on Sanders make no sense. And at some point, you can't blame the national mood or a poor staff or a brilliant opponent for Hillary Clinton's campaign problems. Now, Donald Trump, of course, is very vulnerable himself. There are new allegations surfacing today about sexual improprieties. But trying to pin him for his misogynist attacks on Megyn Kelly, for example, won't work because he's going to respond by attacking Hillary for being Bill Clinton's enabler as a sexual predator. Later in the article, he writes, "A Clinton-Trump match should therefore not just worry Democrats, it should terrify them. They should be doing everything possible to avoid it. A Trump-Sanders contest looks very different indeed." And he argues that against Trump, Bernie can play the same experience card that Hillary has, and that he can point to his successful work as a mayor and then moving up the system in Washington. And he'll be enough of an outsider for Trump's populist anti-Washington appeal to be powerless, but enough of an insider to appear an experienced hand at governance, which, of course, Trump is not. He also argues, and I think this is interesting, that Clinton will be on the defensive constantly and will, in his phrase, feed the troll of Donald Trump. Sanders will almost certainly behave as if Trump isn't even there. He's unlikely to rise to Trump's bait because Sanders doesn't even care to listen to anything that's not about saving Social Security or the disappearing middle class. Sanders is thus an almost perfect secret weapon against Trump. He can pull off the only maneuver that's capable of neutralizing Trump, ignoring him, and actually keeping the focus on the issues. So this is a remarkable think piece. It is riddled with links to the source materials that support Nathan Robinson's arguments. And I urge you, if you're a Hillary supporter, if you're on the fence, or if, like me, you believe that Sanders is the best hope of the Democrats, and he's far from perfect, I frequently have laid out the weaknesses of Sanders. But this is a very unusual year. And one of the final quotes from Nathan Robinson, "One's support for Sanders should increase in direct proportion to one's fear of Trump." The second think piece that's been published in the last day or so came from Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept. And he takes a much more statistical approach, breaking down the polls that have been conducted recently. He writes, "In virtually every poll, Bernie Sanders does better than Clinton, often much better, in head-to-head matchups against every possible GOP candidate." And he looks at how Sanders beats Ted Cruz, and in only one poll does Clinton lead Ted Cruz, and that's by only 2 points. Sanders leads Cruz in every poll, including by substantial margins in some. Clinton's average lead over Trump in various polls is just 2.8%, while Sanders' lead is a full 6 points. And then when you look at the favorability and the negatives that Hillary Clinton carries, that's her real baggage. 51% is the number, the general average of the polls rating her negativity in the perception of voters. And according to the Gallup poll, unfortunately for Clinton, the negative associations currently outnumber the positive ones by a sizable margin. And even among Democrats, the negatives are fairly high. There's another chart of recent polls that shows that the favorability rating of Hillary Clinton is never below 50%, and it peaks in some polls like Quinnipiac and the YouGov Economist at 56 points. Another Quinnipiac poll showed it at 58 points. And there's so many people who just want to dismiss this because they believe in Hillary, because they're committed to her campaign. So Hillary's net favorability rating is a negative 20, and Sanders is a plus 3. And when you put this into the context of this year's campaign and the unpredictability of Trump, the data do not support the notion advanced by Clinton supporters that she is more electable than Sanders. And if she does become the nominee, the amount of effort, the amount of spin, the amount of compromise to accept the various liabilities of Hillary and Bill Clinton, their foundation, the questionable money that has been raised from their speeches that's linked to donors to the foundation who also benefited from favors by Hillary as Secretary of State, hoisting her over the finish line is going to be a very, very heavy lift. And I hope that Clinton fans can come to their senses before it's too late, and we end up with a Democratic nominee who can't win and who paves the way for a Donald Trump presidency. So yesterday in South Carolina, there was a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton, and a couple of representatives, self-styled representatives of Black Lives Matters, showed up. And as she was speaking about the need to reform the criminal justice system, one woman unfurled a self-designed little, it was just like a bedsheet that she had put some words on. So she unfurled this little banner, which is a quote from the First Lady Hillary Clinton back in 1994, which was addressed at reducing gang violence. And she said when it came to young Black criminals and gangs, that she wanted to bring them to heel. And this, of course, has raised hackles. Let's listen to the exchange between Hillary Clinton and this protester in South Carolina.
There's more work to be done, but got to lay down these markers. You got to build toward common sense gun reform, criminal justice reform, and all the like. So I think we've got a very, I think we've got somebody saying here, we have
we
to bring
to apologize
them
for mass incarceration.
To heal. Okay, we'll talk
I'm
about
I'm not
it.
A super predator, Hillary Clinton.
Okay, fine, we'll talk
can
about
you
it.
Can apologize to Black people for mass incarceration?
Well, can I talk and then maybe you can listen to what I say? Okay, not. Thank you very much. There's a lot of issues in this campaign. The very first speech that I gave back in April was about criminal justice reform and about
predators. You're being rude.
That's not appropriate.
That's rude.
Yeah, you want to hear the facts, you just want to talk.
I know that you called Black youth super predators in 1994. Please explain the record. Explain it to us. You owe Black people an apology.
Well, you know what? Nobody's ever asked me before. You're the first person to ask me, and I'm happy to address it, but you are the first person to ask me here.
So the protesters being whisked away, and Hillary Clinton just returns to her the theme that she was addressing and does not offer an apology or recognition to this protester. And this underscores that the both Bill and Hillary Clinton have strong and historic ties to the African-American communities. But I think this is really just a real stunning example of how cold and indifferent Hillary Clinton can be. And this is a situation where she could have turned this around and really gained ground with young African Americans. And she didn't do it. One of the protesters, whose name is Ashley Williams, was quoted as saying, "Hillary Clinton has a pattern of throwing the black community under the bus when it serves her politically. She called our boys super predators in 96. Then she race-baited when running against Obama in 08. Now she's a lifelong civil rights activist. I just want to know which Hillary is running for president, the one from 96, 08, or the new Hillary?" Well, Apple Computer has filed its comments in a brief to the courtroom in Southern California in Riverside, where the judge had ordered them to unlock the iPhone of the alleged San Bernardino shooter. And Apple's lawyers, in a 36-page legal brief, made a rebuttal. They argue that the government seeks a dangerous power that Congress and the American people have withheld, the ability to force companies like Apple to undermine the basic security and privacy interests of hundreds of millions of individuals around the globe. Apple claims the court order violates American speech law under the First Amendment, due process protections under the Fifth Amendment, and leans too heavily on the so-called All Writs Act of 1789. Apple's legal team also argues that complying with the court order would set a precedent that lets investigators regularly force tech companies to remake their products for any run-of-the-mill investigation. The government says just this once and just this phone, but the government knows those statements are not true, the filing says. Once the floodgates are open, they cannot be closed. Now, speaking of security, here's a real doozy for you. In my podcast in the last couple of years, I featured several interviews with Yasha Levine, a scrappy young investigative reporter who writes for Pando Daily here in Silicon Valley. And he disclosed to us the origins of Tor. Tor is the encryption system that many people have relied on to protect sensitive communications over the Internet. And what Yasha Levine revealed to us was that Tor was developed by the U.S. Naval Research Laboratory and to this day receives money from the U.S. State Department to continue its operations. Now we know that Tor was successfully broken by a different government department, the Pentagon, which provided funding to Carnegie Mellon University, which carried out research attempting to de-anonymize, to take away the anonymity, of people who use the service. And apparently it was used to crack the black market Silk Road, which led to the conviction of its operator. And so this is fascinating, that we have this system that was created by one government agency, funded by another one, and now the Department of Defense is able to pay Carnegie Mellon in order to hack into what was, at least offered, as the only reliable encryption system available to average people. And Yasha Levine pointed out that the government had an interest in seeing Tor used not only by spooks and by people in countries where they feared their communications might get them killed. Human rights activists are often used as an example of why Tor was developed by the government. But this really shows that our government doesn't believe in encryption and security. And I think that the case I just described, the Carnegie Mellon research, is another example of how ultimately Apple probably won't win this. I think they're going to have some court victories, but I don't think that the government will ultimately stay out of our business. Yesterday, I told you that the Republican governor of Nevada was an unlikely individual under consideration to be appointed by Barack Obama to the vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court. And I pointed out that I thought it was a head fake, that they were going to put Brian Sandoval through the process in order to see some Republicans say, "Oh, well, if he's the nominee, I'm going to ditch Mitch McConnell And I'll support hearings and confirmation of a presidential nominee. Well, I thought it was an interesting head fake. It produced outrage and howls from some liberal groups like Charles Chamberlain over at Democracy for America. It's downright absurd that President Obama would risk his legacy by appointing another anti-labor Republican like Governor Sandoval to an already overwhelmingly pro-big business Supreme Court. Well, Brian Sandoval withdrew his name from consideration today. He doesn't want to run that gauntlet, and I don't blame him, but I'm relieved because there is the possibility that Mr. Grand Bargain himself, Barack Obama, might actually make an appointment like that. The 8-member Supreme Court, as I mentioned yesterday, is likely to leave a defining stamp on abortion rights in this country. And it all depends on whether Justice Kennedy will go with the so-called liberal bloc on the court and overturn the trap laws, the targeted regulations for abortion providers that have sprung up in state legislatures and been signed into law by Republican governors all across the country. Now, we talked yesterday about the Texas law, which is up for oral arguments next week on Tuesday in the Supreme Court. And today, a similar case from Louisiana has been teed up to follow the Texas case to the Supreme Court if they end up with a 4-4 split on the Texas case. So I hope you can follow all this, but the bottom line is that yesterday the appeals court in New Orleans lifted its stay on the Louisiana trap law that requires admitting privileges at a nearby hospital for any abortion doctor. And this is a pretextual law intended to shut down abortion clinics because these are standards that are set because they cannot be met. And what is really outrageous is that the 3-judge panel in New Orleans on the appeals court bench said, quote, "We reversed the district court and permitted the law to go into effect because the plaintiffs had not demonstrated that the law placed an undue burden on a large fraction of women." I mean, that's outrageous. That is ignoring what is obvious right before the court. And so it's likely that abortion clinics will be shutting down in Louisiana, and that Louisiana will be the next state where it's legal to get an abortion. You simply cannot access it. So you've got the right, but they've denied you the ability to use it, and that is not an undue burden on a woman's right to choose? I find that just incredible. Every day I like to pause for a minute and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Brian Mazzi, Andy Krieger, Olivier de Mirlot, who lives in Switzerland, and many others. I appreciate your support of my work, and I need more people to sign up with your subscription dollars to keep it all going. Because of my strong opinions, there's some people who've said, I don't want to listen to that guy anymore, and so they have moved on, canceled their subscriptions. I need you to step up. Come to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu button, then become a subscriber. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. And for our new annual subscribers with a mailing address in the U.S., I've got your choice of bonus books, including Joe Hickman's powerful expose of military negligence called The Burn Pits, and a fun book about the F-bomb, the English language's most powerful word. Ben Parker's book covers the waterfront about the F word without actually spelling it out a single time in the book. So if you want one of those books, first sign up for a new annual subscription, and then I'll send you an email and ask you which one you want. It's that easy. The other thing we're supporting here, of course, is the NewsBud crowdfunding campaign to raise the money to start a new independent media outlet later this year. And I'm happy to report that we're closing in on 950 contributions, and we're closing in on the $100,000 mark. I need you to continue to support this. Go to newsbud.com. Share that link with friends on Facebook, Twitter, wherever you go. And if you are financially able, I hope you'll step up and contribute to the NewsBud campaign. Interesting report from today's New York Times with a full-color graph that I'll link to in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. The Economic Innovation Group has done a study of cities across the country that have lagged in recovery from the 2008 Great Recession. And I'm going to run them down for you in order here, the top 10 most distressed cities in America. Number one is Cleveland. Number two, Detroit. Three, Newark. Four, Toledo. Five and six are San Bernardino and Stockton, California. Then Milwaukee, Buffalo, Memphis, and the city where I was born, Cincinnati, is ranked the 10th most distressed city in terms of the recovery from the recession. And it shows, for example, that the percentage of adults not working in Cleveland is north of 50%. In Detroit, it's north of 60%. And the number 10 city in Cincinnati is still an unhealthy 44% of adults not working. So it's just an interesting snapshot of the uneven recovery, and that many Americans are still hurting very badly from the blunders of 2008. And quickly through some stories that you deserve to know about. It appears that the ceasefire proposal for the Syrian war is gaining some traction. The Assad government has agreed to a two-week break. The Syrian opposition that's funded by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, called the High Negotiations Committee, they've agreed to a two-week truce. Now, Putin and Assad have emphasized the need to continue an uncompromised fight against the Islamic State, the al-Nusra Front, and other groups which are considered terrorist under the UN Security Council list. Well, that means that this is not a complete ceasefire. And the government will be free to attack the Islamic State and take advantage of the stand down of the other forces to try to gain ground and consolidate control. So, I certainly would like to see an end to the violence in Syria. But the formula that's being advanced here and the way it is being brokered and supported doesn't give us much confidence that it will actually take effect and then hold. Last week, I told you that after a U.S. airstrike in western Libya, that this was the first round, the first salvo in the new war on Libya. And I have more evidence to support my notion here. Two stories from Vice News today. First one reporting that France has covert military forces on the ground in Libya right now. The newspaper Le Monde has received information suggesting that France is currently involved in Libya. French special forces are carrying out unofficial military actions, and their security intelligence agency is leading covert actions. And a former secret agent is quoted as saying, this type of action often serves as a preamble to a larger intervention. And that's what I am expecting here. I hope I'm wrong about this, but all the signs are very clear. And here's another one, again from Vice News, that the U.S. has finally extracted from Italy permission to launch drone strikes from a base in Sicily. The base is called Sigonella, and it's on that island of Sicily. It's only about between 200 and 500 miles from the coast of Libya. And this makes it much more attractive than flying drones out of Djibouti or Spain or some of the other places where we have permission. Now, the Italians have put strings on it, saying that they want to approve each specific drone attack before it happens. But, of course, we've lied to the Italians before, and the Abu Omar case that we've discussed recently is just one example of that. And finally, today from our department called This Won't End Well. Yesterday, the lower house of the legislature in the state of Iowa, by a vote of 62-36, approved a bill that permits children under the age of 14 to have a pistol, revolver, or ammunition while under parental supervision. Now, already in Iowa, children can legally use long guns and shotguns under adult supervision, but not handguns. Now, what on earth would propel these gun huggers in Iowa to say, you know what we need is we need to allow younger kids to get access to pistols? I mean, this is just so irrational. But Jake Highfill, a state representative who supports the new law, says that it gives the power back to parents. Allowing people to learn at a young age the respect that a gun commands is one of the most important things you can do. The alternative is turning 18 with no experience. Now, this is a false choice. I certainly don't object to parents who take their kids hunting or to a shooting range. But there is no need to expose kids under the age of 14 to handguns or to help them develop proficiency in using them. And unfortunately, what's going to happen is that with access to handguns and the legal approval that is given if this bill becomes law, there are going to be more gun deaths. And it's going to be loved ones who kill each other, either accidentally or in a moment of passion. And this is what we live with in the U.S. of A. in 2016. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast that we distribute free, and you are free to share it with absolutely everyone. I hope you will. And I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until